One thing I wanted to start with is just to mention that this has nothing to do with the study, but after living here in Holden for 3.5 years, there's quite a few times of being in this place and leading classes and teaching classes. And something that humbles me is I always remember the first time I taught a class at Holden Village, the very, very first time. And I had come here many years and listened to teachers, and I always thought, will I ever actually sit in that chair and teach a class? So in a summer, when we moved here, I was asked to do a 4 o'clock in the afternoon session along with 3 other sessions. In the summer, and it was in one of the chalets, and I was very nervous, and I worked hard, and I got everything together, and I studied, and I got a good title, and it got announced, and then 4 o'clock came, and I stood on the porch. It was in the living room of the chalet, and I watched, you know what I'm going to say? I watched all the people streaming up to the sessions, and nobody came to So that was my beginning. Well, I'm probably most of you know one of the campus pastors at PLU. And what I'd like to share tonight and tomorrow night is something I really kind of got roped into several weeks ago. And that was at PLU, there's a study called ISP, which is called Integrated Studies Program. Which is one way that students go through their 4 years at PLU instead of taking separate classes in different fields of study. They take so many hours of what is just called ISP, where they have teachers from different disciplines. And the classes are not called literature or history or art. They're called things like imaging the world, imaging yourself, so on and so forth. Well, anyway, one of these classes, they were studying the cosmologies of different religions. So the two professors asked me, will you come and present the cosmology of Christianity? And I said yes, without knowing what I was going to do. And then when I started to think about it, I realized how interested I was in the cosmology of other religions, like the enjoyment of looking at how the Navajos structured the universe, or when we lived in New Mexico, how the Pueblo Indians structured the universe. And I never thought we did it. I always thought we just had the truth, and then all these other religions have pictures of how they structure the universe. Do you follow what I'm... And all of a sudden I had to go and say, well, do we have a way of kind of organizing reality into stories and pictures? And then I'm a visual person. Can I actually gather that all together and put it in a picture to present to this class of students at PLU? And then the whole question is, how does Jesus fit into our cosmology? And so I just worked on it, and I came up with the picture of what I call our cosmology. And then I discovered, I think there are really two. There are really two ways of picturing the way reality is. And part of this is so interesting to me is, what is there about human beings that as a community you just kind of have to get it all together and get it into a picture? And it's something that a community does, and all communities do, and form these kind of pictures of reality. So I'm going to draw what I think is a biblical cosmology that has been adopted by the Christian church and expanded, and probably the cosmology most of us grew up with is something that came out of the Middle Ages, medieval times, maybe is more influenced by Dante than it is by the Bible. But I'll just draw a picture. What color? Here is reality, or the cosmos. And then in this reality, you have a pocket, and the pocket is heaven. And then the ruler of the entire cosmos in the Bible is a picture of God, the heavenly ruler, enthroned in the heavens over everything. Okay. Then you have heaven, and then you have earth, and in the biblical way of setting it up, it's on four pillars. Do you know that? It's on four pillars. And then it is surrounded by the primal waters. The primal chaotic waters. Losing juice. Then you have mountains, which are the kind of, they're the things that hold up the sky. And then the sky is a bowl on the pillars of the sky. And then the sky then separates the waters from what is the firmament, or the space in which we live. And then on the sky, of course, are the sun and the moon and the stars. And then the sky has little holes in it that when everything is in order, they let through some of the water in a very controlled manner. A storm would be when the chaotic waters break through in a way that is disruptive. Then under the earth, which is on the pillars of the earth, and I never figured out what these pillars stand on. Anybody know that? That is relegated to the realm of mystery. Is this fun? Okay, then under the earth, under the earth you have Sheol. Is that spelled right? Sheol. Later this became a place of fire. Maybe even earlier. Now, you have on the earth, you have lakes and rivers and the primal waters and also springs that come up where the primal waters come through here. You also have like volcanoes and things where the fires of Sheol break forth on the earth. But part of the whole order of the heavenly God is all of this chaos is kept in control. And then on the earth, then you have the creation, the crown. Oh, by the way, in the heavens here, you also have the angels and more angels and more angels. And then on the earth, you have the crown of creation, which is the human. Then you also have all of the animals and the birds of the air, the fish of the seas that are here. And then human beings then are under God then as caretakers of all of the creatures of earth. So now a point I have to make is that when science kind of taught us that this isn't how the world is actually set up, we maintain the mentality of almost everything here except the exact scientific details. So maybe we could talk about how that happens later, but in spite of all of our science, I think for most of us growing up in the church, this kind of cosmology remains. God enthroned, God is up, heaven is up. There's heaven, there's hell, the place of human beings, a certain kind of hierarchy of creation. We talk about, we still use these categories. What do you think? Did I leave anything out or what? Now, the next thing I have to go in are that we have a story that goes along with, and this is what I kind of call the stage setting of the story of our universe and our world, for those of us who understand everything biblically.
How far back does this go? What's the, how long has this story been with us?
It's all over the Old Testament. And what I'm working on, and I just need help, with this, but I think that in Old Testament times that a very rigid cosmology like this came more from the court gathered around the king of Israel, and then the alternative cosmology that I'll show came more from the prophets. But this, and you notice how neatly this would fit into kingly Israel. Just as God is seated on the throne, creating order over the whole structure, so on earth is the earthly king here doing the same thing as creating order. And it's a system that's very static in a way, and the kind of prime value of creation is order out of chaos. And the danger and what you pray to the heavenly God for is a continual holding back of the chaos of the waters. Crying to God for protection against the chaos breaking through the orderliness of creation. This cosmology takes place every day in my office. As the primal waters in terms of piles and papers and junk gradually move in towards me. And then you have to create this kind of push it all out and set up and it comes back.
The vault big enough to breathe.
Yeah, you gotta get the vault out there. Does this ring bells with what would be some examples of the way we grew up that kind of were words and phrases and prayers and everything that kind of fit into this?
Our Heavenly Father.
Our summer theme.
Our Father.
Our Father in heaven. Our Father who art in heaven. And then our holden summer theme, on earth as in heaven. If you follow this cosmology, the meaning of that petition then is that heaven is the place where everything is perfectly ordered. And earth is a place where that order is really disrupted, and praying that on earth may become like heaven in its orderliness and in its functioning. Should we look at the story and how the story fits in with this? And
is hell there?
Sheol becomes hell. It kind of evolves into. It's like Rand McNally map makers. You constantly have to kind of redo the map. And you could have a whole history of how Sheol is kind of to our forebears in the faith. When you died, Sheol was where everyone went. And that was kind of a shadowy, sleepy place where you were kind of halfway in consciousness and halfway out of consciousness. Kind of like the first minute you wake up in the morning and you're groggy. facility. To our forebears, the life after death was kind of eternal grogginess in the Sheol. And that gradually evolved into hell and a place of fire and eternal punishment. And notice how our directions still are. Hell is down, heaven is up. And then we even use those as value. You know, what is up is better, what is down is more evil. Yeah.
Where does purgatory come in?
That would have been much later. I don't know exactly where it is in the geography, but it would be, you know, as we move into more medieval cosmology, which I think have inherited, you know, then the main purpose of life here on this stage Earth is to live in such a way or be in such a state that when you die, you will go to heaven instead of hell. And then purgatory became a place of further purifying before
it
went to heaven.
Out in the cleansing waters out there.
But
it probably lateralized out into the cleansing waters out there on the side.
Purgatory was out here in the chaotic waters. Some of the rich symbols, you know, is baptism is really the... When Paul said we are buried with Christ, we die in baptism, it's like the crucifixion of Jesus. And water is to move into those chaotic waters and really die in those waters. And to Hebrew people, water and death were one and the same thing. The oceans were places of terror and places of chaos. And one of the most triumphant passages in the book of Revelation was this glad and glorious announcement, now there is no more sea. You know, we say, what's so great about that? Like, we like going to the beach. But it is that wonderful promise that the chaotic waters will be no longer in existence in the new heaven and the new earth. And then it's really symbolized in baptism, is going into those waters, dying, and then coming back to life. Already I think you'll see the possibility of the real danger of this cosmology, and that is the danger that Earth and creation become kind of a stage setting for something that happens on that stage, which then leads to what we call in theology the separation of history and nature. Now, what I think in Old Testament covenant theology, though, that there was a certain preservation from that, and this is, I think, how it went. God is a ruler. God has created all. God has created human to be partner with God in caring for the orderliness of this creation. But the human rebels. Now, sin in this cosmology is disobeying the ruler king. And by disobeying the ruler king, it's to live outside of the kind of harmony that the ruler king has commanded. And that commandment is in the covenant. And when the covenant is kept, then the human being lives in a harmony with the whole created order. When that covenant is not kept, then the human being lives in a disorder and an enmity with the world and nature around him and her. But the emphasis is on that God is the king and the ruler, and then sin is to disobey that ruler, and it's really sin then is rebellion. There's also in that kind of a movement towards a natural hierarchy, of the human being over all of creation, and the really temptation of that becoming not only dominance but domination. By the time we get into Christian times, and especially medieval times, the stage setting has been moved from kind of God ordering a kind of a community that will live in harmony of this whole creation of order that is in the midst of the chaos. But then it begins to move like now Earth is a stage, and then each individual walks across the stage by himself or herself. And then the reason for walking across that stage is to determine at the point of death whether or not you will go to heaven or you will go to hell. You notice how the change from the covenant living into kind of an individual journey across this stage, and that even divorces the human even more from nature. Nature becomes just more of just a background stage setting for the drama of salvation. Then out of that comes the very kind of intricate kind of theologies of what is Jesus. And the death of Jesus on the cross is the heart of God. I'm losing my juice.
There's some other ones up here.
The heart of the ruler God is one of love and compassion. So languages and that the heart of God in love and compassion sends God's Son to earth, because in order for humans to attain heaven when they die, they cannot do it without perfection. Because God demands holiness and perfection. So then humans, because of their sinfulness, are separated from God. So God sends God's Son to die on the cross, and then to take upon himself the punishment that humans deserve, and then by receiving that in faith, then the sins of the humans have now been put upon Christ. So now the alienation between this human walking across the stage and God is now broken. There is a fellowship restored. That human now, because of the sacrifice of Jesus, is saved, and then has the joy of knowing that he or she will go to heaven at the time of death, and also to live a certain heavenly form of life here on earth, because by the cross, that alienation between God and human has been broken. And now, then, all of kind of church and everything we do of church then kind of centers around that. Baptism is so you're given the gift of the sacrifice, so you will go to heaven when you die. Evangelism is bringing individuals into that state of receiving the gift of atonement, so they will go to heaven when they die. But more and more, everything here kind of fades back into, again, just what I call a stage setting for kind of the testing of the individual life. But then the cosmology of what is heaven and what is hell becomes even more pronounced. And because science has kind of ended, this is really geography, then these become spiritual places somewhere in the universe. Well, because we're sophisticated modern people, we don't accept this is the way it's really physically structured anymore, as our ancestors did. Well, what do you think of that cosmology?
I think it looks like a UFO there. The vault and the little feet
landing and the feet. I was also going to mention that, and we'll want to look at this more tomorrow when we specifically talk about the life of Jesus. But at the time of Jesus, the very purpose of this whole, the whole cosmology was accepted. And what the ruler God of the universe in love was doing was, had created for, I don't know what reason, had created a people on this earth who were pure. And this was the delight of the heart of God that there was now on this and within this cosmos a people that were pure. And then within that purity were certain hierarchies of purity. And we're going to look at that. And there were the, I really call them the A people, the B people, the C people, and the D people. And each was more pleasing to God. And this is, well, we're going to look at how Jesus didn't accept this cosmology and got into all kinds of trouble because of that. The God being up here has, and you, the beginnings of this, I think, are in the Bible, is the hierarchies that we live with of the ladder of value. Meaning you have the male, female, human, and then higher animals, lower animals, and then the inanimate objects down to the slugs, to they're down here.
People below the lower,
what's that? They're below the lower animals. And then you go all the way down to the rocks. And
ahead of or behind
dirt.
Vegetables?
What's that?
Ahead of or behind vegetables?
Vegetables are above slugs. And maybe, you know, it's an argument about whether or not is that inherent in the biblical story, in the cosmology we have in the Bible, or is it something humans and their sinfulness have added to it? I don't know.
Isn't this something more that we've kind of pulled out of other religious traditions?
Yeah.
Great chain of being.
Mm-hmm. Well, there'd be a real argument about that. When we were up here last December, wasn't there one teacher up here that was just certain that it was, this hierarchy was so inherent in our biblical tradition and in the Bible that we really have to go out of the biblical tradition to get away from that kind of hierarchy. There's some that would argue that. Yeah. Shall I move on? Could I ask this question? Do you think most of us grew up with some form of this? How do you? Or maybe this is our only kind of picture of how the universe is constructed. Now I'm trying to draw another form of this, and then tomorrow I want to talk about, is there a way to understand Jesus in another kind of a cosmology? So this one, you know, might include some of the former, but I do think it comes more out of the prophets in the Old Testament rather than from the kind of kingly royal literature. And it would see reality more as a flow. And this one's harder to picture because it isn't static. But it's a form of movement that would be both the movement of nature and the movement of history. Both the story of creation and the story of humans within creation. And this cosmology would have a sense of human memory. And that human memory would be the memory of a beginning when everything was whole and everything was united and everything worked together and everything in creation was connected, and the memory is that humans in their consciousness somehow broke away from this movement of nature and humans in nature that carried on a pattern and a life together, really call it a life together of beauty and wholeness. And went on their way to, instead of living within the unity, to become isolated, insulated, and selfish.
Could you as well have put that up as down?
Uh-huh. Yeah, I will, just to throw us off. This is called the fall. Ever seen a map of the world that's completely upside down? You know, you just see South America up there going that way. And then after you look at it for a while, you say, well, who decided we should look at it the other way? Who decided that? And when you go south, you go down. And I'm convinced a lot of these things, down has less value. South has less value. People in the south have less value. The farther south you can go, the more you can exploit them. I mean, I think there's all... Okay, so this is the fall. And it's... The fall is really moving out of the flow. As everything goes together. And then God in this is not on a throne up above it all, but rather God is in the midst. God is in the midst. And then what is God doing in the midst? And the words then of God's action now are not what does the king demand, and how can we humans be saved so they meet the demands of the king? But now the concern of God would be talked about in terms of healing and mending and unifying and bringing together. And mending would also have the sense of restoring. And then what fills all of the movement as it has been disrupted is hope. And hope is that vision of the future when all will be healed, and all will be mended, and all would be united. And the Jewish people had a word called shalom. And then there will be peace. Then all things will live in their connection, or their interconnection. And in the biblical word, then it will be a time when righteousness will prevail. Now, I believe this is also a cosmology that's in the Bible, and it's okay to say that there's a real sense in the Bible of a competition between the two cosmologies. And I think like a Walter Brueggemann maybe doesn't use these words like cosmology, but it really brings it out in terms of the difference between the prophetic tradition in the Bible and the kingly tradition. And if I have a way of saying this, I think we in the church, and we have grown up in the church, have adopted the kingly, royal, static, hierarchical cosmology that maybe is in the Bible, and there's an exciting other alternative cosmology that is just there waiting for us. I don't know. What do you think of
this one? Didn't take as long.
What?
This one didn't take as long.
Well, I haven't. Yeah, you mean it isn't? Well, it's not as neat in order. But I don't think it. Why did it take as long?
The thing I thought of as you were talking about the future and the memory of the past is the theme of a couple of years ago, Jesus is the memory of our future.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody could ever figure out, but now it's obviously very clear.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's even more clear when you start to talk about how the meaning of the Jesus event in this. And then it's even more clear when you say Jesus is a memory of our future. That instead of the emphasis of God the King sending God's Son to die on the cross as an atonement, so humans will be saved and go to heaven when they die instead of hell. Now the Christ event becomes the ultimate of God being completely in the process. In a human being, Jesus Christ, who... And notice the major, major theme of Jesus is the reign of God. And you'll notice in our old cosmology how little we ever talked about the reign of God. But now in this, we again see that the most important thing that Jesus talked about was the reign of God is among you. And if you use this as a way of kind of structuring reality, what Jesus was doing was seeing the future. Jesus had a vision. Jesus had a dream of that future. And then Jesus lives that vision completely in the present. In a way, Jesus brings the future into his present, as he says, the reign of God is in your midst, the reign of God is here, the reign of God has come. And then, now, if we're living here in the movement, then it's so clear that old theme of Holden, Christ is the memory, we look back to Christ, Christ is a memory of our future. And what is sin in this? What would sin be? It's a little different than just disobeying or rebelling against a cosmic king, a deity.
It's something on the order of destruction.
No, we could.
Or disconnecting.
Disruption. Disconnecting. And I would love if, to work more on this, is to have a whole list of Bible passages on each side. You know, the ones that are the more royal, kingly. You know, and one of the, you know, one of the major ones would be the Apostle Paul saying that the whole creation waits in longing, in travail, in the birth pangs, waiting with us for redemption. And it's a way of saying that the human disruption has a ripple effect that touches all of creation.
I guess what I'm trying to get at, I don't know if I'm using the language adequately, thinking of this as a prophetic tradition, thinking particularly of the prophets and their cries against social injustice and, mm-hmm. and so forth and so on. I guess it's the kind of sense of forcing a wedge in to make the thing come apart would actually be the sin, not the disconnectedness itself, but the actual act of creating or causing would just be a disconnection.
Mm-hmm. And the way the prophets, the Old Testament prophets, really, I think they were involved in both kind of cosmologies, but especially they had a dream, just like Jesus, of God's future. And then ethics was what we call anticipatory ethics. You know, what will the world be like when God's reign is complete? And then the pleading with the people to do what Israel is called to do, and that is in a world of disorder, or a world of disunity. Disunity is probably a better word than disorder, would probably fit more with the other. Then a world of disunity will be a community of people who live that future.
Well, I was just going to say, it occurs to me that that the theology bubbling out of the third world, South Africa and Asia and Latin America, and also black theology
and feminism.
And feminist theology of the United States of North America is basically anything new. It's just recapturing this kind of cosmology as opposed to the more kingly one, which is what European and North American theology is primarily focused on. And I think because the people in those situations, the poor, are more able, not because they're great visionaries or that sort of thing, but just simply because of their own situations, are more able to read the Bible with those eyes, I think.
Mm-hmm.
That's a little bit of a challenge to them.
The meaning of church as community in this cosmology is that, you know, is a people who really in a future time with Jesus live that vision of God's future. And the strangest thing I think we met was in Mexico in a base Christian community was this weird Lutheran heresy. And that is like, it's kind of a Lutheran heresy to ever say you can do it. Because we are lost in sin, and all we can hope for is that this will happen in heaven. But the arrogance to ever say that it could happen here on earth, even if we pray that in the Lord's Prayer. You know, and then to meet people who actually believed they were living God's future in the present. And they were. You know, they needed forgiveness and mercy and all that. Now, what does the cross of Jesus mean in this? Was it necessary? You know, Jesus says, on the road to Emmaus, it was necessary that the Christ should be crucified and thereby enter his glory. I had an interesting experience. This class that I presented this at PLU, neither of the professors are Christians. Neither are, and one got so excited at the end because I had really tried to describe how the Christ event is so important to this. And he says, what I'm really excited about is you could take all of this out and I can be part of this flow going to this without these symbols. And then the two of us are together on our way to the future. And he said, and it was a very beautiful thing in a way. He said, he's, I think, a person that has had some real hurts with the Christian faith, as many have. And he says, this is the first time I've heard a Christian talk where I really felt I could be included without buying all of your symbols. And then all of a sudden I started thinking, have I been teaching some heresy? What's that about?
Probably.
The cross for me is, and I'm not sure if where struggle fits into this, but social struggle and, you know, ecological struggle and all that is inherent in it. And the cross is a way to wage struggle and to ultimately find union in struggle by accepting suffering to me.
It's the mystery. The mystery in this is, it's close to our Vespers tonight. The mystery in this, that is, it is in the pain of the struggle that actually brings or ushers in. Very specifically in the Christ event, it is those powers that benefit from a disrupted creation that are threatened by any movement towards unity, and therefore a Maria or anyone who is in the flow of unity becomes a threat to their selfish benefits, and so they lash out, and then the ultimate is the lashing out of the very God in the flesh, who lives completely the flow of God's history. And then by the act of the cross becomes the very power that pulls together. And I think you said it there tonight. I mean, it was Marie's resurrection that... But we look to the cross as a very power. Jesus says in John, when I am lifted up, I'll draw all to myself. Gandhi once stood before a crucifix in Vatican City. There's probably, have you ever thought in the Vatican how many crucifixes are hanging on the walls? Gandhi, Mahatma Gandhi, tells a story of being at a meeting and all of a sudden he stopped before a crucifix and he says, I couldn't leave. My eyes could not leave. And I became convinced right there that it is only in this kind of suffering that the world will ever be made whole. I hear a deep, deep awareness. This is just starting of trying to kind of show these two, but I would like as much help as I can get, because I think it's important to help people in the church actually see, and because I think the destruction of our creation is so closely related to the old cosmology and what we have done with it. And this is what I call the old, old cosmology. It needs a rebirth. Okay, well, I'm going to stop. We're late and we're tired. But tomorrow, to look real specifically at the ministry of Jesus as one who counters the disunity, and then lives that unity, and just exactly how Jesus does that. But I just to close tonight, because this is closing inspiration. Part of just putting this on the board for me is to try to get into my own head and my own heart what I think Joseph Sittler lived most of his life, in counter to almost the whole church. And do you all know who Joseph Sittler is? An old Lutheran theologian, University of Chicago, probably a personal friend of Valerie's. He told this story once when he was traveling in Israel or Palestine or the nation of Israel, and his car broke down. And he went into a Sabra mechanic, you know, an Israeli mechanic. And when he was in, and he left for a few hours and then came back. When he came back, the car, which had been just choking and, choking and belching. When he came back, it was running perfectly. And it had been the carburetor. And when he got back, this proud mechanic who spoke Hebrew pointed to the carburetor and said the Hebrew biblical word for righteous. Zedek. And he had him repeat it several times. I want to make sure, is that the word you were using? Huh. And it means righteousness. And Joseph Sittler said it all came together for him again, that when God's plan is a world of righteousness. You know, the old way, that means, okay, that means morally good. But righteousness, it meant in that engine, in that carburetor, every part was working together for the good of the whole and for the completeness of the whole. And that is righteousness.